That's nice. I'd like to welcome you here, Lucy, on behalf of the Intertribal Graduate Council. I also want to do the commercial for all you guys in the hall. I'll make this quick so you don't have to stand any longer than you have to. These things are $2 out front. Buy one. Got some books. $7. Buy one. $15 out front.
Yeah. He deserves a big hand for that, huh? Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Lucy Tapajanso. Lucy is presently working as an assistant professor at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. She's written a number of books, among them One More Shiprock Night, Seasonal Woman, A Breeze Swept Through, and her new manuscript, which will be published by the University of Arizona Press in the Suntrack series, we hope in the next year, is titled Sani Da Hadle. And she can fix that when she comes up here, but I'm trying, Lucy. The subtitle, the translated title, is The Women Are Singing, a very fine manuscript that we're all looking forward to seeing in print. Among the many honors inspired by Ernie, keep this very brief, but there's one honor of Lucy's that I wanted to mention among the many that she's earned for her work, and that was an honor she received this year when she was recognized as the Grand Marshal at the 68th Annual Northern Navajo Fair Parade in Shiprock. So here she is, the Grand Marshal from Shiprock, Lucy Tapajanso.
Thank you, Larry. It's Sani da Hadle is the title of that. Not Ani Nez de Yeshinasha, though Twitic Ocean Schlesh is yet with each eating le Kintle Cheatney, Shinalla than le, though Shiche Desh Cheatney than le. I am from Shiprock, New Mexico, and so I was very honored and very pleased to have been selected for the parade honor, because I had always gone back every year for the Shiprock Fair, and it's something that's really important to my family and to myself. And so I'm glad that Larry mentioned that, because it's really, I think that it's just an honor that is for me something that can't be surpassed, because it's from my own home community, and it's all my relatives and my friends, people I grew up with, and people I went to school with, and my former teachers. And it's really the place that I'm from, so I'm pleased. I was very pleased about that. I'm going to start with a prose piece called It Was a Special Treat, that is about that area of New Mexico in the 1960s, when I was growing up in the middle, late 1960s. It was a special treat. Trips to Farmington were a special treat when we were children. Sometimes when we didn't get to go long, we cried so hard that we finally had to draw straws to decide fairly who would get to go. My oldest brother always went because he drove. My other brother went because he helped carry laundry. My father went because he was the father. And my mother went because she had the money and knew where to go and what to buy. And only one or two kids were allowed to go, because we got in the way and begged for things all the time. We got up early on the Saturdays that we were going to town. We would get ready, sort laundry, and gather up pop bottles that we turned in for money. My father always checked the oil and tires on the pickup, and then he and my brothers would load up the big laundry tubs, securing the canvas covers with heavy wooden blocks. We would drive out of the front yard, and the unfortunate ones who had to stay home would wave goodbye sullenly. The dogs chased the truck down the road a ways before turning home. In Farmington, we would go to the laundry first. It was always stark and clammy inside. We liked pulling clothes out of the wringer, even though my mother was nervous about letting us help. After that, we drove downtown and parked in the free lot north of Main Street. Sometimes my father got off at the library, and we picked him up after we finished shopping. Someone always had to watch the pickup, and usually the one who was naughty at the laundry had to sit in the pickup for 2 or 3 hours. Then everyone else got to see things around town. If my father didn't go to the library, the kids were off the hook, naughty or not, because he waited in the pickup and read the Reader's Digest. When we stopped at Safeway, our last stop, it was early evening. My mother would buy some bologna or cooked chicken in plastic wrap trays and a loaf of bread. We would eat this on our way home after the groceries were packed in securely under the canvas and wooden blocks. We loaded up again and started to drive west to Shiprock. We talked about who we saw, what we should have bought instead of what we did buy. Maybe we would exchange it next time. Then the talking would slow down, and by the time we reached the Blue Window gas station, everyone but my father was sleepy. He would start singing in Navajo in a clear, strong voice, and once in a while my mother would ask him about a certain song she heard once. "Do you know it?" It was something like this, and she would sing a bit, and he would catch it and finish the song. We listened half asleep. I would whisper to my sister, "He sounds like those men on Navajo Hour." "I know, it's so good," she'd answer, and we slept until we arrived home. This is called Braiding a Daughter's Hair. Each night I braid her hair, my fingers slip through the thick silkiness, weaving the strands into a single black stream. "The air feels like something will happen," she says. "Maybe it will snow." The moon outside is a silver arc in the cold sky. In the old stories, they say the moon comes as a beautiful horse, I tell her. From the bedroom window, we look out at the glistening night sky. It is outside the house, the frozen night. It glimmers with her pleas for snow. It glimmers in her night dreams, a fusion of music, laughter, talk of boys and clothes. It glimmers here in the fibers of my bed sheets, there above the old roar of the Kaw River. It glimmers in the western sky where he thinks of me and smiles. In an old story, a woman and her daughter were alone in the winter, and the mother said, "Tomorrow, if the sun rises, it will come as many different horses." This poem is one that I wrote. I guess I consider this my first Midwestern poem. It's a poem called "De Twitte," and the meaning of that becomes obvious in the poem itself. The skin behind one's ear is exquisite, thin, delicate. De Twitte, de Twitte, I hear words from your mouth, wet and warm with breath. It is said that the wind enters each newborn, a whoosh of breath inside, and the baby gasps. It is wet with wind. It is holy. It is sacred. Such energy we are, with wind inside, alive, alive. Tell me words from the warmth of your throat, mouth, down to darkness of heart, beaten, beaten. It travels then to my ears, mine, skin surrounding it, de twitte, cradling the pulse. My pulse, mirror of heart, gentle, steady organ, swaying in red warmth inside me. Inside me, all that ever ate, all I have cried about, all I have laughed through. Tell me words of healing, words of holiness, utter slowly into these wires of magic, magic, 900 miles shimmering with care and tears. My doctor said, take these every day. The only effect may be a slowed heartbeat. It is so. Speak to me words. My heart quickens a bit, reaching back into recent days, last month, for pulses missed, skipped over as I slept in darkness. My heart beats slower, slower. Two beats slide into one. I sleep on. A dream scene is much too slow, but anything can happen in dreams. Later, as I walk down the aisle, selecting cuts of meat, in between picking up something tasty and easy to fix, and a roast to simmer all day, steam rising warm and spicy from the oven, my pulse slowed. It remains there, beaten above shiny tile and chilled air, a small space of loneliness. Your voice retrieves the missing pulses of my heart. It works. It works over distances of hills, flat plains, lonely silos, and sturdy houses of the Midwest, and I am healed. Your breath of words secure beneath the solid white bone around my ear, and my pulse continues steadily. Your words, your life swirls inside the dark depths of my own body. This is called Light a Candle. The other night, thunder shook the house and lightning slashed brilliant blue across the bed. I slept in bits. My heart raced with each explosion of noise and rain, and though he held me, my breath was ragged and exhausted. I may never sleep through these storms. Hector, light a candle for me. Last week, we returned to our birthplace, and as we drove through southern Colorado, we were stunned by the beauty of autumn leaves, the deep, cool mountain canyons, and twice deer stood beside the road. They watch as we pass through their land. Their eyes glisten black softness. Misty said, isn't it neat we see them on our way home? Hector light a candle for her. In a small reservation town, a little boy shakes his mother. She is passed out on the floor and he is hungry. Mama, he says, can you make some potatoes? She stirs. Leave me alone, damn it. He climbs up on the counter, takes down a box of Cheerios, and sits back down to watch TV. The noise he makes eating dry cereal is steady and quiet. Hector light a candle for him. Some evenings, Leona just wants to sit with her sisters and mother around the kitchen table and talk of everything and nothing. Instead, she sits in the quiet kitchen, and outside, leaves blow against the window. The wind is cold and damp. In front of Leona, the table stretches out clean and shiny. Hector light a candle for her. North of here, the car rushes westward, a wide, muted roar. The trees sway and brush against each other. Dry, thin leaves swirl in the cold wind. The river smell and heavy wind settle into my hair, absorbing the dull, thundering water, the rolling waves of prairie wind. This time, I have walked among the holy people, the river, the wind, the air swirling down from the hills, the silent grace of eagles as they snatch their prey, the exhilaration of the biggest catch, the silent pleas of those who drowned here. Hector, light a candle for me. Light a candle for me. You know, when I moved there, I was very amazed by the size of the rivers there. And I realized that what we consider rivers here is not really a river at all. I'm going to read this poem for Rahul and for his grandmother. It's called All I Want. All I want is the bread to turn out like hers just once. Brown crust, soft, airy insides, rich and round. That is all. So I ask her, how many cups? Ah, she says, throwing flour and salt into a large silver bowl. I don't measure with cups. I just know by my hands. Just a little like this is right, see? You young people always ask those kinds of questions, she says, thrusting her arms into the dough and turning it over and over again. The table trembles with her movements. I watch silently, and this coffee is good, strong, and fresh. Outside, her son is chopping wood, his body an intense art. The dull rhythm of winter is the swinging of the axe and the noise of children squeezing in with the small size of wind through the edges of the windows. She pats and tosses it furiously, shaping balls of warm, soft dough. There, we'll let it rise, she says, sitting down now. We drink coffee, and there is nothing like the warm smell of bread rising on windy wood chopping afternoons. This is a poem called Last Year the Pinions Were Plentiful. And earlier today I told a story, the story behind this one, which is altogether a different story. But I wrote it in this form so I wouldn't get into trouble. So last year the pinions were plentiful. It took only a late night phone call, listening and laughing in the bedroom dark. Her husband was lying right there, but one-sided conversations never make sense. And it made no sense right from the beginning. The blue moonlight slid down the long center curve of his back as he got up to take a drink of water. After the phone call, she had snow-laced dreams where she was trying to catch the dark horse and the other watch, chuckling under his breath. She smelled chamisa when she woke and knew what had happened. Far away, the other was going to feed the horses beneath Tuahale Mountain. The air was heavy with rain scent, sage, and rabbit brush. But here, the morning light bolted into the room in streaks, where her nightgown was a rumpled heap under the bed, and she remembered only the phone call and the time she followed him into the trading post, a skinny dog at her heels. He bought her a Coke and they sat on the dusty steps outside, not even talking. The sun was hot and sticky, fine dirt settling on them. That was when he said, "It's better here in the spring. Maybe you'll come back then." As she drove off, she saw him in the rearview mirror mounting the dark horse. That was how it was that day. Here she cleaned the house thoroughly, and at noon he called again, saying, "Come on out. The clouds are still real low in the mornings, but it warms up. We can ride over the mountain if you want." And she did. I have no choice, she told herself, leaving her nightgown on the floor, and her husband waiting at lunch. She took the next trailways to Gallup, a radio, and a can of coffee. People saw them at the trading post at Newcomb, reading the bulletin board. They left on the dark horse toward Two Gray Hills late in the afternoon and weren't seen again that spring. It doesn't make sense, her husband said. She seemed happy. But happiness had nothing to do with it, and years from now her grandchildren will understand, saying, back then, those things always happened. That was last year. The pinions were large, and the winter so cold, so cold. Beneath Tuolumne Mountain, the white desert shining with snow. I'm working on a project for the city of Phoenix, and it has to do with the new expressway that recently opened. I think it opened in December. It's the Hohokam Expressway. In order to put in that expressway, they had to excavate and remove hundreds of remains of Hohokam people who used to live there centuries ago. So my part in this difficult project is to document and commemorate the existence of the people that live there at one time. And so this is a prose piece that is about meeting with a medicine man in that area, and a part of that whole series. Conversations at Gila River Art Center. We met on a spring Saturday at the restaurant for breakfast and talked for hours. The morning was warm and the sky a bright blue emptiness. There's that mountain north of here, he said. You passed it driving over. We've always been told not to climb it, and we never have. It has a tempting and dangerous face. And so it seems like people who aren't from here can't resist trying to climb it. One guy was looking at it and asked, you ever climb it? Nope, I said, too dangerous. And the voice that's talking in here is the medicine man. Actually, there are spirits who live there, and some of the most sacred places to our people are located there. At certain times, the medicine men will go up to make offerings or to receive blessings. They're the only ones who can go up there. The kids around here know this too. Maybe they don't understand exactly why it's forbidden to them, but they know what the phrase, and then he said a phrase in his own language, what that phrase means. It's something to be respected and something to be feared. Anyway, this guy has to meet this challenge head on. So he gets ready and a couple of days later tells me he's going up so that somebody will know where he is. I wished him luck and told him again that I thought it wasn't a good idea. He smiles and leaves anyway. A few days later, I saw him, and he was on crutches. He had slipped before he reached the top and fractured his leg. He was kind of embarrassed, but he wasn't the only one that happened to. The holy people take care of themselves, they do, just as they take care of us. So I really like these old stories and always feel good when someone wants to hear them and to know about what we believe in and what we know. That's the Indian way, to sit and tell stories together. Each tribe is the same and the story's different. It's a good thing, this storytelling. As we were finishing our breakfast, his daughter came in with her two small children. She had come to teach a class in basket weaving in another part of the center. She was surprised by the enrollment and pleased that so many women wanted to learn the old tradition of making baskets. When she was a child, she asked to learn, and her grandmother taught her. In preparation for the class, she had gone out to gather the plants needed and soak them overnight in large metal tubs. She would tell the women where the plants were and when to gather them. This morning, the dozen or so students followed her across the patio to their classroom. They were mostly Indian, maybe one or two non-Indian women. They followed her, this 23-year-old Pima woman, and her little children ran to catch up, pouting, unwilling to share their mother. As I left the center, there were two tourists coming in, and across the road, people were at the store talking and laughing. Some were setting up tables facing the highway, getting ready to sell jewelry, beadwork, tamales, and fry bread. There were huge jars of dill pickles and swivel racks of colored syrup for snow cones. Patio umbrellas were going up. The sun was already overhead, and there weren't any trees nearby. I pulled over and went to see what they had to sell. "Bet you're Navajo," one guy said to me. "Bet you're Hopi," one guy said to me. I just laughed and said, "Navajo." "Hey," he said, "I could have started a war here." Everybody nearby laughed, and I told them where I was from and that I was doing some writing for the city. A woman told me about her son who had married a Navajo and now lived in Santa Fe. "It seems so far away," she said. "We hardly go up there, but at least they come back here every once in a while." "It is far," I said. I told her about my parents and how I worried about them sometimes. "They're getting old and get sick more often now," I added. "That's the way it is," she said. "They're a lot stronger than we think, though." And we smiled. I bought the fried bread and Diet Coke and started back to the car. Come back again. "We're always here, selling and getting rich," one of the women said, laughing. "Tell everyone at Hopi we said hi," they teased me again. As I drove back to Phoenix, the traffic was heavy and the air hot. Heat waves shimmered above the freeway. Off to the side, there were the huge plants used for basket making, and the mountain a looming dusky purple. In a matter of minutes, I was part of the traffic rushing into the city. The roar of cars and planes above pushed inside the car, where the radio sang out loud, and I drove on, alone except for my silent breathing. Later in the day at the Pueblo Grande site, as I looked over the place that had been excavated and the huge cement pillars now installed there, the voices and stories from earlier in the day stayed with me. The construction crews had left the equipment parked in neat rows, and the ground beneath was a dry brown color, newly dug, and the presence of pottery pieces, bone shards, clothing fibers, or any other signs of a former village were imperceptible. Yet I knew that they had been there. We had seen the small paper sacks of excavated remains standing upright in the bright sun. And we stood in the middle of their homes all these centuries later. The silence was heavy, and I sat down under the trees, still wanting to talk, laugh, and share stories. "We're all still here," I said to the Hohokamki, whose homes and burials were disturbed, "and we are still the same. There are memories and stories too powerful for something as new as cement and asphalt to destroy. The worlds I had entered that morning were the prayers and hopes that they had thrown ahead for all of us. It is the same now. We pray several times each day for ourselves, our children, our ancestors, and our grandchildren. We call it throwing our prayers. Our prayers are thrown 7 generations ahead." This is what this place, known as the Hohokam Expressway, embodies for some of us. this is a poem called It Is Night in Oklahoma. The used air in a plane and the still air in a wide terminal is no different than the vast sky shared with other silent travelers. To most people, our leaving is nothing more than a hollow roar, than an empty runway space. It is night in Oklahoma when he walks toward me, his voice low and eyes brimming from that raw place inside. His brother's death is a jagged sigh flooding him. It has taken him back to his birth, the first faces he knew, Mother and Tommy. The long, humid afternoons of his boyhood, trapping crawdads and wrestling washed over him. How sad the dirt-stained pants, the old TV shows flickering black and white. The days of high school are framed with longing. Now on long football afternoons, his step will waver when he gets up to call his brother, then remembers. He will walk nearer me as we journey through music-filled stores, hugging bright secret packages, all around us listening tinsel and forced cheer. There are no words for this anguish. His brother is dead. From the airport, I drive back through the dark, frozen street, squeezing his hand. He sits beside me, his breath ragged, wet. We cross the black yard, slick with ice, and enter the house. My steps are small and frightened. Inside, we circle the room with corn pollen, sprinkling old words, sprinkling old pleas for help and wholeness. We move the furnitures around, straighten the room as his people have always done. These rooms gather us in, yet hold the empty space left by death. Later, he holds me in the darkness. He holds me breathing into my hair thawed from the ice night air and damp with exhausted sighs. As his smooth hands slide down my back and legs, I suddenly feel drunk, but then I recognize the frightening dizziness that grief causes. Slowly, slowly, we move into each other. That warm, familiar slickness. It seems all we have in the torn winter ahead. In other rooms, perhaps troubled spirits hover in the dark air, above the same old furniture, above sleeping limp bodies, and above the covered pans of food on the counters. But in here, we breathe each other's skin, move to feel our pulses beating. And this is the only reassurance of our own tender lives, our own tender lives. I'm going to read this. This is a series of pet stories. So I'll read one. There's several in this series. And this section doesn't really have a title to it yet. But it's from the series. At home, they say Navajo shouldn't buy or sell dogs. Why would you buy a family member anyway, they ask. Navajo dogs are expected to be responsible. My father's dogs respond only to Navajo and don't understand English. They are courteous, extending their paws when someone says yat eh to them. Some years back, we had a dog named Sandoval, after old man Sandoval, who lived south of us. My father pronounced his name Sandoval, and because that was what he called his old friend. Sandoval would ride by our house on his horse with five or six dogs running alongside. He wore a tall black hat and exchanged silent, calm waves with us. We missed him when he died, but at least we had the dog, Sandoval. My parents were without any pets for a few weeks or so because someone or something was stealing dogs and cats in the farm area where we live. it was strange and everyone talked about it. They would speculate and become suspicious of any unfamiliar vehicles in the area. Each time I talked with someone in Shiprock, they told me the pets were gone, and wasn't that just awful? They even talked about devil worshippers and Satan cults, but that was just too much to imagine. We knew that the pets were quite handsome and valuable for the animal nappers to resist. One day, my sister was unloading her car. She had just driven back from work at Tuahalin when a blue pickup drove up. A woman leaned out and said, "Are you people missing a dog?" "Yeah," my sister said, putting everything down. "Well, I know where your dog is," she said. "But first, don't ask me my name or where I'm from." "Okay," my sister said, grown excited by the minute. "There's a woman by the last name of So who lives at Ojo Amarillo. She's the one that stole your dog. She's sure bragging about it, saying she stole a good dog from the Tapahansos. She's just bragging around up there. So if you want your dog, that's where it is," she said. "That So lady's my sister-in-law, and we don't get along. That's why I told you this," she added and drove off quickly. My mother said after that Crime Stopper came, everyone knew about it. They were out to find that soul lady. She was suspected of stealing more than the dog. An aunt who lives at Ojo Amarillo heard about all this, and she found out where this woman lived. She called a Navajo police officer for help. This officer had also been asking her out. He said in his official capacity, "I'll help you recover your parents' dog." That night around 9, the officer and my sister went to the suspect's house, and the man answered, and upon seeing my angry aunt and the law said, "Go ahead, go on in and get the dog." Their children watched silently as they walked to the backyard. There was no sign of the offending dog napper, the soul lady. So at least they found the dog and took it. My aunt was sure glad she had some influence with the law enforcement. That same night after 10 p.m., my aunt and her kids arrived at my parents' home some 20 miles away. "Who's that so late?" my mother mumbled, looking out the front window. "My sister, we have something for you and Dad," my aunt said, showing her the dog. Everyone was happy, and they all settled into the kitchen. They told about how they found the soul lady and how they confiscated the dog with the help of the law. By now, the other sister had come over from next door. Finally, they all had to leave. The kids had school the next day. That night, they went to bed happy, at least to have at least one dog. A few days later, my mother called another sister who had given her Dale, the Doberman puppy that was stolen. She asked, "Did Dale have his ears pinned?" "Yes," my sister answered. "Was his tail cut?" my mother asked. "Yeah," my sister answered. "I have the rest of it over here." She lives on the other side of the Chuska Mountains. My mother said, "Was Dale a boy dog?" "Chip and Dale are both boys," she said. Chip was Dale's brother, and he remained at my sister's home. "Oh dear," my mother said, "your aunt brought the wrong dog back to me. This one's ears just flop around and it has a long tail. Joe's been acting like it's a female." Joe had also been missing and had just appeared on the porch one morning. He had just run off. He wasn't the type of dog to get stolen. "Oh dear," my mother said, "Joe has a wife." The last we heard, Joe was happy with Dale, or whoever we thought Dale was. And there's this little section about Joe. There was a dog named Joe. Once my mother went out to the porch and yelled out, "Yo, Joe!" We were all surprised because we thought only Marines and miners yelled, "Yo!" aloud to answer roll call or phones. And here was my mother saying that all the time to call Joe. Sometimes he came running when we call, "Joe, babe!" And we just laughed and laughed because Joe babes were girls at Indian boarding school who teased their hair, wore lots of mascara, and wore white go-go boots when that was the style. One could tell Joe was not a boarding school product. My mother didn't say yo the way I said it. She has a much tougher way of saying it. There's a classic poem called Leda and the Swan. And so people are always doing takes on it in different ways. And so this next poem is I guess, the Indian answer to Leda and the Swan. It's called Leda and the Cowboy. A few months back, when the night sky was darker than Leda had ever seen, she stepped through the worn doorframe of the Q Lounge. The suddenness of thick, smoky air left her slightly faint. After that, it was easy enough. Leda saw him across the damp, just white bar. She did nothing but hold the glance a second too long. Sure enough, as if she called out his name, he walked over, a slight smile and straw hat. Even then, as they danced, the things he told her were fleeting. Leda smile and a strange desperation engulfed him. "I have to leave," she said, remembering the clear, empty air outside. He followed her, holding her shoulder lightly, and outside he bent over, his body an arc in the streetlight, and it was clear he didn't know the raw music she lived. But for now, he's leaning across the table, smiling and telling Leda things. He wants to take her on a picnic. It might rain tonight, and she can phone him any time. He thinks he is leaving for a rodeo 400 miles to the north in a few hours. His pickup is loaded with saddles, clothes, and a huge ice chest. Leda notices the parking lot outside is stained with oil, twist cigarettes, and small bits of colored glass. He leans toward her, hat tilted, and in that low morning voice says he has been tracking her all night. In this desert city of 1 million people, he drove over cool asphalt trails, searching smoky dance halls, small Indian bars, the good Mexican place that serves until 11. And when he found her, she was laughing at a table near the shiny dance floor. But Leda saw his straw hat and half smile as he watched from the bar. When they danced, it was flawless. He thinks he has done this many times before. His shirt carried the scent of the hot night breezes outside. East of here, above the dry fields of the Hohokamkee, the stars are sparse. And as he follows Leda through the stark beauty of the old stories, he has already left his own life behind. So then, this leads right into a much, much requested poem called Raisin Eyes. So raise an eyes. I saw my friend Ella with a tall cowboy at the store the other day in Shiprock. Later I asked her, "Who's that guy anyway?" "Oh, Lucy," she said, "I knew what was coming. It's terrible. He lives with me and my money and my car. But just for a while, he's an AI RCA and rodeos a lot, and I still work. This rodeo business is getting to me, you know, and I'm going to leave him because I think all this I'm doing now will pay off better somewhere else. But I just stay with him, and it's hard because he just smiles that way, you know. And then I end up paying entry fees and putting shiny Tony Llamas on layaway again. It's not hard, but he doesn't know when I'll leave him and I'll drive across the flat desert from Red Valley in blue morning light straight to Shiprock so easily. And anyway, my car is already used to humming a morning song with Gary Stewart complaining again of aching and breaking down and out love affairs. Damn, these Navajo cowboys with raisin eyes and... ...for that all the time, she said with a little laugh. This is, in a sense, I guess it's an epic poem. It's called In 1864, which was the year that over 8,000 Navajos were forced to walk from Tenetra, which is Navajo country, to Bosque Redondo in southern New Mexico. It was about 300 miles that they walked, and they were held there for 4 years. And then the government allowed them to go back, and over 2,500 people died of different kinds of diseases and starvation. And so the survivors came back in 1868, 4 years later. So this is sort of based on that. While the younger daughter slept, she dreamed of mountains, the wide blue sky above, and friends laughing. We talked as the day wore on, the stories and highway beneath became a steady hum. The center lines were a blurred guide. As we neared the turn to Fort Sumner, I remembered the story. A few winters ago, he worked as an electrician on a crew installing power lines on the western plains of New Mexico. He stayed in his pickup camper, which was connected to a generator. The crew parked their trucks together and built a fire in the center. The nights were cold and there weren't any trees to break the wind. It snowed off and on, a quiet steel blanket. The land was like he had imagined from the old stories, flat and dotted with shrubs. The arroyas and washes cut through the soft dirt. They were unsuspectingly deep. During the day, the work was hard and the men were exhausted. In the evening, some went into the nearby town to eat and drink a few beers. He fixed a small meal for himself and tried to relax. Then at night, he heard cries and moans carried by the wind and blowing snow. He heard the voices wavering and rising in the darkness. He would turn over and pray, humming songs he remembered from his childhood. The songs returned to him as easily as if he had heard them that very afternoon. He sang for himself, his family, and the people whose spirits lingered on the plains, in the arroyas, and in the old windswept plants. No one else heard the thin wailing. After the third night, he unhooked his camper, signed his time card, and started the drive north to home. He told the guys, "Sure, the money's good, but I miss my kids, and it sure gets lonely out here for a family man." He couldn't stay there any longer, the place that contained the pain and cries of his own relatives, the confused and battered spirits of his own existence. After we stopped for a Coke and chips, the storytelling resumed. My great aunt had always started the story saying, "You are here because of what happened to your great grandmother long ago." They began rounding up the people in the fall. Some were lured into surrendering by offers of food, clothes, and livestock. So many of us were starving and suffering that year because the Balaganas kept attacking us. Kit Carson and the army had burned all the fields, and they killed our sheep right in front of us. We couldn't believe it. I covered my face and cried. All my life we had sheep. They were like our family. It was then I knew our own lives were in great danger. We were also afraid of that man Red Shirt and his army. Some people hid in the foothills of the Chaska Mountains and in Canyon de Chelly. Our family talked it over, and we decided to go to this place. What would our lives be without sheep, crops, and land? At least we thought we would be safe from gunfire, and our family would not starve. The journey began, and the soldiers were all around us. All of us walked. Some carried babies. Little children and the elderly stayed in the middle of the group. We walked steadily each day, stopping only when the soldiers wanted to eat or rest. We talked among ourselves and cried quietly. We didn't know how far it was or even where we were going. All that was certain was that we were leaving the Netra, our home. As the days went by, we grew more tired, and soon the journey was difficult for all of us, even the military, and it was they who thought all this up. We had such a long distance to cover. Some old people fell behind, and they wouldn't let us go back to help them. That was the saddest thing to see. My heart hurt so to remember that. Two women were near the births of their babies, and they had a hard time keeping up with the rest. Some army men pulled them behind a big rock, and we screamed out loud when we heard the gunshots. The women didn't make a sound, but we cried out loud for them and the babies. I felt then that I would not live through all this. When we crossed the Rio Grande, many people drowned. We didn't know how to swim. There was hardly any water deep enough to swim in at home. Some babies, children, and some of the older men and women were swept away by the river current. We must not ever forget their screams and the last we saw of them, hands, a lake, or their hair floating. There were many who died on the way to Huelta. All the way we told each other, "We will be strong as long as we are together." I think that was what kept us alive. We believed in ourselves and the old stories the holy people had given us. "This is why," she would tell us, "this is why we are here, because our grandparents prayed and grieved for us." The car hums steadily, and my daughter is crying softly. Tears stream down her face. She cannot speak. Then I tell her that it was at Bosque Redondo they learned to use flour dough, and now fry bread is considered to be the traditional Navajo bread. It was there they acquired an eternal appreciation for strong coffee. The women learned to make long tiered calico skirts and fine velvet shirts for men. They decorated their dark velvet blouses with silver dimes, nickels, and quarters. They had no use for money then. It is always something to see, silver flashing in the sun against dark velvet and black, black hair. I'm going to do one short one and then finish up with a combination of poetry and song. This is a poem called Hills Brothers Coffee, which my uncle calls the Catholic coffee, the Catholic's coffee. My uncle is a small man in Navajo. We call him Shaddai, my mother's brother. He doesn't know English, but his name in the white way is Tom Jim. He lives about a mile or so down the road from our house. One morning he sat in the kitchen drinking coffee. "I just came over," he said. "The store is where I'm going to." He tells me about how my mother seems to be gone every time he comes over. "Maybe she sees me coming, then runs and jumps in her car and speeds away," he says, smiling. We both laugh just to think of my mother jumping in her car and speeding. I pour him more coffee and he spoons in sugar and cream until it looks almost like a chocolate shake. Then he sees the coffee can. "Oh, that's that coffee with the man in a dress, like a church man. Oh, that's the one that does it for me. Very good coffee." I sit down again and he tells me, "Some coffee has no kick, but this one is the one. It does it good for me." I pour us both a cup, and while we wait for my mother, his eyes crinkle with a smile, and he says, "Yes, ah, yes, this is the very one," putting in more cream and sugar. So I usually buy Hills Brothers coffee once or sometimes twice a day. I drink a hot coffee, and it sure does it for me. So I'll end with this one. It's called "The Motion of Songs Rise," and even though it's not really winter yet here, it's winter at home, so we're okay, because this is a winter thing. "The Motion of Songs Rising." The October night is warm and clear. We are standing on a small hill, and in all directions around us, the flat land listens to the songs rising. The holy ones are here dancing. The Yetis are here. In the west, Shiprock looms above the desert. Tsepita, old bird-shaped rock, she watches us. Tsepita, our mother who brought the people here on her back, our refuge from the floods long ago. It was worlds and centuries ago, yet she remains here, Nihima, our mother. This is the center of the night, and right in front of us, the holy ones dance. They dance surrounded by hundreds of Navajos. The Na'o'huyui, the Na'o'huyui. We listen and watch the Holy Ones dance, Ye'ibiche, grandfather of the Holy Ones. Awe, ahi, 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 awe, ahi, ahi, ahi. They dance, moving back and forth. Their bodies are covered with white clay, and they wave evergreen branches. They wear hides of varying colors, their coyote tails swinging as they sway back and forth. All of them dancing ancient steps. They dance precise steps, our own emergence onto this land. They dance again the formation of this world. They dance for us now, one precise sway in motion. They dance back and forth, back and forth. As they are singing, we watch ourselves recreated. Oh, we are here, here, here. Oh, we are here, here, here. Eils isigi oshetln jane. The little clown must be about 6 years old. He skips lightly about, waving his branches around. He teases people in the audience, tickling their faces if they look too serious or sleepy. At the beginning of each dance, when the woman walks by to bless the yetis, he runs from her. Finally, after the third time, she sprinkles him with corn pollen, and he skips off happily. Oshetln jön. Oh, we are here, here, here. Oh, we are here, here, here. Yetis are dancing again, each step our own strong bodies. They are dancing the same dance, thousands of years old. They are here for us now, grateful for another harvest and our own good health. The roast corn I had this morning was fresh, cook all night, and lift out of the ground this morning. It was steamed and brown just right. Oh, we are here, here, here. Oh, we are here, here, here. They are dancing, and in the motion of songs rising, our breathing becomes the morning moonlit air. The fires are burning below as always. We are restored. We are restored. I want to thank you all for coming, and I really want to thank the people out in the lobby who have, who are very patient people. Thank you. Hagana.